I'm Lynn Willis, and I, last year, when I was here for the first time, I happened to open my mouth and just ask if anybody might be interested in a class on over-the-counter medication, and the answer was yes, and so there I am, I had to do it. How many of you were here yesterday? Okay, just one. Okay. I had to modify things a little bit yesterday because we had a big crowd yesterday, but they all left on that afternoon, and so they were only going to be there for one session, so I tried to condense some things into that session. If you're going to be here for the weekend and you find that this is something you want to be involved with, then I will be covering maybe on Thursday a good bit of what I covered on Monday. What I'm doing with this session, these sessions, is aimed principally at making you the folks in charge when you go looking for an over-the-counter remedy, and not be the victim of all the advertising ploys and promotional gimmicks. And what I hope you'll see after we go through some of these classes of drugs, you'll see how simple the selection process really is once you understand what lies beneath the surface. And what I had intended to do and will be doing is to cover what amounts to the three major categories of drugs that are out there and remedies that are out there on the open market. There are the conventional over-the-counter remedies like Tylenol and Pepcid and Afrin spray and this sort of thing. These are very tightly regulated, relatively speaking, by the FDA. Then there are the dietary supplements, which would include the herbal remedies that are out there now. Most people assume that these are also regulated fairly tightly by the FDA, but the fact of the matter is that they're not. They're governed by a totally different law that the FDA has auspices over, but it's a law that in no way compares to the law that regulates over-the-counter drugs. And so the buyer beware part of shopping for dietary supplements and herbal remedies is a very big part of that kind of shopping process, where it's not such a big deal with conventional over-the-counter remedies. And then there's another category of drugs, which in past years I wouldn't even discuss in a setting like this, but I noticed that these remedies are now being sold side by side in many drugstores, which offends me, but sold side by side with conventional over-the-counter remedies and certainly with the dietary supplements, and these are homeopathic remedies. You may not even know what a homeopathic remedy is, and if you don't, stick around and come back on Friday, and we're going to devote the whole session to homeopathic remedies. But those are the three major categories of non-prescription medications that are out there. Today and tomorrow, we're going to focus primarily on the conventional over-the-counter remedies. And I always start a talk like this with a quote from one of the grand old men from clinical medicine, Sir William Osler, who says, "The desire to take medicine is perhaps the greatest feature which distinguishes man from animals." And he also said at one point that the principal duty of the physician is to convince his patients not to take medicine. And this was said in the late 19th, early 20th century, somewhere around there. But I think it applies very well now. If you don't have a reason specifically to take a particular medicine, then don't do it. And I think that's good information. Now, I always like to get a feel for who I'm with in a setting like this. My training is as in pharmacy primarily, or initially, Oregon State University, go Beavers. But then I went to graduate school shortly thereafter and got my PhD in pharmacology and never looked back. And I spent my career doing basic animal research, mostly having to do with kidneys and blood pressure control and that sort of thing. But then teaching pharmacology to medical students and dental students and nursing students and such as this. That's me. Are there any health professionals in the group here? And
hi.
Hi.
I'm a RN.
Great.
Med-surg nursing.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Did you?
Yeah. I'm a doctor, chiropractor, too.
Nutritionist, dietitian.
Oh, excellent. Outstanding. Okay. Well, we'll have some interesting chats then when we get to the dietary supplements, I'm sure. That's great. Okay, well, let me press on here. I always, on the first day of class when I'm retired now, but when I was teaching the medical students, I would say very important that you understand some cardinal principles of pharmacology and lock them away in your brain. Never forget them. These would be such things as all drugs are poisons. There is nothing that we can put into our body that is not a poison if we take enough of it. Even water will put us into severe difficulty and kill us if we drink too much water. And so some of the folks who promote their particular remedies, particularly you see it on the internet and in some of the print forms of advertising for non-prescription medications, they'll say, perfectly safe, no toxic effects. Well, if you see that, discount that completely because it is not true. The only thing that I would say comes even close to being safe would be a homeopathic remedy, and that's because there's nothing in a homeopathic remedy. and we'll discuss that when we get a chance to. The other cardinal principle of pharmacology is that no drug has a single action. Whenever most people take a drug like an aspirin for their headache, all they're thinking about is that headache. And they're assuming that that's all that drug is going to do is to relieve that headache. Well, aspirin does a lot of things. Aspirin affects temperature control if you've got a fever. Aspirin affects the platelet function in your blood. That has to do with blood coagulation. Aspirin has an anti-inflammatory action. And if you push the dose of aspirin, you can recruit other really messy effects associated with aspirin. And this is true for any drug. All drugs have multiple actions. Whether you see one or not depends on how much of the drug you have administered. And I'll have occasion here today to show you how that process works. But the actions of drugs that are recruited as you increase the dose, increase. It's just the way things are with pharmacology. And then there's always, I have fun with this with my medical students, because when I show this to the medical students, I make them guess what's in the red as we go along. We play what is the professor thinking, but we're not doing that tonight. But I always stump them on this idea of, well, what is the proper dose of a drug? And the proper dose of a drug, pharmacologically speaking, is whatever it takes to produce the effect that you want to achieve. And as we're going to see as we go through these this session, some people are more sensitive to a drug than another, so it will take less of a drug to produce a desired effect than in other people. And so what it takes to produce a desired effect is enough of that drug to do it. So these are the cardinal principles that I would encourage you to remember. Now, we'll start our walk through some over-the-counter remedies. I thought we would start off with a fairly straightforward one, over-the-counter pain relievers. And again, we're talking only about the conventional over-the-counter drugs tonight. So what we'll be talking about are ibuprofen, acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, and aspirin, and a couple others in this category of externals. So there are pain relievers that we take orally. The FDA-approved ones in this category include aspirin, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and naproxen. Naproxen is the newest one into this arena, and it's essentially the same pharmacologically as ibuprofen, and it's very closely related to its pharmacology with respect to all of these drugs, but these two especially are related. The difference that naproxen brings to the picture is that you only have to take a dose of this every 12 hours. You get a sustained effect with the naproxen, whereas the rest of them are dosed on intervals of 4 to 6 hours. They are equally effective for relief of most types of pain, but the clinical literature would say that ibuprofen and naproxen are probably a little bit better for more severe types of pain associated with sprains, back pain, acute back pain, menstrual pain, this sort of thing. But it's kind of a subjective thing as well. And if aspirin or acetaminophen fit the bill for you, fine.
Ibuprofen works for buried fish hooks in your finger.
Yes, it works good for fish hooks in your finger, right. Oh, that reminds me. I should say, as we go through here, I want this to be as informal as it can be. So if you have a question or you want to take issue with something that I have said, just either raise your hand or just speak right up and we'll stop and we'll talk about it.
I have a question.
Okay, well,
I know that aspirin differs from acetaminophen because acetaminophen is like Tylenol is for pain, but doesn't have the
doesn't work for inflammation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about ibuprofen?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We're going to go through these one by one.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And of course, these things are also, all four of them are effective against fever. The external products are kind of an interesting mix. They're in a category that we call the counter-irritants, and I'll explain what that means in a couple of minutes. But within this group, we've got a collection of old-time drugs. These would be what you could call natural drugs because they're derived, for the most part, from plant sources, but camphor, menthol, methyl salicylate. These are the things that you'd find in Bengay, for example, that you rub on sore muscles and so forth. And then a newcomer, relative newcomer to this group, is something called capsaicin. And we'll talk about it too. It's an interesting one. It produces pain relief, but it's got some differences that set it apart from everything else. And its claim to fame is that its capsaicin is actually the chemical that makes hot peppers hot. And it has some interesting pharmacology associated with it that we'll discuss. So first, let's go through a quick review of aspirin. Aspirin itself is not what relieves your headache. Aspirin is what allows salicylic acid, which is part of the aspirin molecule, aspirin is what allows the salicylic acid to get into the blood. Once it's in the blood, then the salicylic acid is released into the blood because salicylic acid by itself is not well absorbed from the stomach, and it's very irritating, more so than all of these are. These all can produce irritation of the gastrointestinal tract, but salicylic acid is a fairly caustic substance by that comparison. And so aspirin gets converted to salicylic acid. It inhibits this $2 word here, prostaglandins, which are mediators of inflammation. And they also are involved in the regulation of body temperature. And so it's through this mechanism, and all of these drugs we'll see, all four of these drugs interfere with the formation of prostaglandins to one degree or another. Aspirin comes in several different varieties. There's just old regular tablets of aspirin. There's aspirin with an enteric coating. Now, an enteric coating is something that's on the tablet that prevents the tablet from being dissolved in the stomach acid. And it doesn't dissolve until the tablet passes into the intestine, which is much less acidic. And it releases the aspirin then into a very large volume of intestinal fluid compared to what's in the stomach. And the likelihood that there'll be irritation of the intestinal lining goes way down. So this is a means of minimizing the irritation to the gas, to the stomach that aspirin can produce. There's buffered aspirin, like Bufferin. I don't know, that may not even be on the market anymore, but when it was there, and maybe it's still there, and you can find buffered types of aspirin yet, this is aspirin that's combined with an antacid. The idea being that, if it reduces the acidity in the stomach, this will reduce the tendency for the aspirin to irritate the stomach lining. And then there's the sustained release form of aspirin that you can get. This is, there are many drugs, many prescription drugs especially, that are available in sustained release. It's you take one tablet and you only have to take one a day, or maybe one every 12 hours. It releases the drug slowly over a period of time. That's what the sustained release. So if you see a label that says aspirin SR, sustained release, ER, extended release, that's what these things are referring to, mostly. And of course, the aspirin is good for your minor aches and pains, your sore throats, fever, menstrual cramps, so on. And it's also used in low dose. Many of us, I'm doing this, and many of us who are at risk of a heart attack or stroke are taking our one aspirin tablet a day at 81 milligrams. And at that dose, the aspirin inhibits the action of our platelets that are circulating in our blood. Doesn't do anything for headaches at those doses or pain, but that's how that's being used. It has an anti-inflammatory action, but really only in the higher doses. Maybe at the very highest of the extra strength dosage that we'll discuss here. But in many cases, the doses of aspirin that are needed to relieve the inflammation of severe arthritis only come when a doctor prescribes high doses that go beyond what have been approved for over-the-counter use. There are people who are allergic to aspirin, and obviously they shouldn't take it. The big cautionary item relating to aspirin is its association. It's never been established as cause and effect, but it's enough of a relationship that the FDA says, and it's with good reason, don't give this drug to children under the age of 15 because of this very severe RISE syndrome that popped up a few years back. It will, in cases where the drug is used continuously over periods, relatively long periods, days to weeks, it can cause stomach irritation and bleeding, and this is especially a problem for folks, it turns out, who are over the age of 60. It should be avoided in pregnancy. I think most drugs should be avoided in pregnancy in any case, but certainly this is the case with aspirin. There is a risk of poisoning with aspirin. I think, I don't know where it sits now in the rankings, but not too many years ago, it was in the top three of poisonings, accidental poisonings primarily, but also deliberate poisonings. When it was in accidental, it was usually in kids who got a hold of the aspirin bottle and consumed it. Salicylate poisoning is a big deal. It can be lethal. And so with the advent of the childproof caps and so on, this helps, but it doesn't eliminate the problem. So you always need to keep that stuff where prying hands can't get at it. And the other thing that I will promote heavily in these kinds of discussions is that you buy your over-the-counter drugs generically whenever you can. There was a time when there was a fair amount of controversy over generic drugs, and you can ask the question, you know, you get what you pay for. But with generic drugs, what we know now is that the FDA requires that generic drugs be manufactured according to the same standards that the brand name drugs have been manufactured to, and the FDA is a real stickler about this. Where there was some controversy for a while was whether or not the generic product behaved the same way in the body as the more established brand product. That is, did it dissolve as well? Did it release the drug into the system as well? Well, now we know that in most cases, these generic drugs that the FDA permits on the market pass the test for bioequivalence as well as chemical equivalence. And your pharmacist will know. If you have a question about a product that's generic and you take to the pharmacist, actually, I believe that if the pharmacist has it on his shelf, then he already knows, or she already knows, that that there is chemical and biological equivalence. But in any case, my whole view on the use of generic drugs is you're in charge. And so you can give it a try. And you can try, say you're doing aspirin. Try the generic aspirin. If you like what you get, the results are fine, great, you're ahead. Your money ahead, because you're not having to buy the more expensive brand name. If you don't like the way it's working, then you can buy the brand name product. And you've made the decision, and it wasn't the advertising that's made the decision. So that's my pitch for generic drugs, and I'm a big believer in generic.
Question.
Yeah.
How does the pharmacist know that these drugs are manufactured properly?
Well, for the conventional over-the-counter drugs, the FDA takes care of that. That the drug will not get on the market until the FDA is satisfied that the manufacturing process meets all the requirements of the official USP requirements for that drug. And for many generic drugs, it's the company that made the brand name drug in the first place that is providing the generic chemical.
Concern is that that some of the generics are manufactured in China, or
sure,
Singapore, or Puerto Rico.
This is a problem for dietary supplements, because the FDA doesn't have the power under the law that regulates them to control and set manufacturing standards for these things. For the conventional over-the-counter drugs, it's the same as it would be for prescription drugs. The FDA has very tight, very closely monitored standards.
Do they monitor the individual manufacturers?
Yes.
For prescription drugs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Let's see, where was it? Okay, so let's move then to, and the pharmacist will have a publication these days that lists the drugs that have been tested for biological equivalence, and will have passed the test for biological equivalence, and that's how the pharmacist will know. Acetaminophen works the same way, and it's also effective against minor pains, including migraine-like pain. But as was pointed out earlier, it's not useful for the treatment of inflammation, which is, for a pharmacologist, this is very interesting, because we're talking about inhibition of the same set of mediators. So there must be something else going on with acetaminophen, but I don't think we really understand that yet. Its main claim to fame is that it does not cause gastric irritation. And so if aspirin gives you troubles, and so does ibuprofen, then acetaminophen is a good substitute. It comes in a variety of forms, tablets, capsules, and liquid. Aspirin is not going to come in a liquid form, because aspirin in solution is not stable, and it will break down. And in fact, we'll get to this. But with acetaminophen, it is stable in solution. The problem with it, though, is that it is toxic to the liver. And in fact, there's a new rule change going to go into effect soon, where the maximum dose is going to be reduced now from 4 grams a day down to 3 grams a day. There's enough concern about that portion of the population, those with liver disease, those who are taking drugs that have the potential to damage the liver, or those who consume more than 3 alcoholic drinks a day. Acetaminophen in high dosage represents a very serious risk. You damage your liver to the point that it's not going to work. You're in real serious trouble.
What percentage of medications are hepatotoxic?
There are a fair number. I mean, but these would be in the prescription drug classification. And the physicians will know they will have been forewarned which ones they have to worry about. And when the prescription, if you were to get a prescription for a drug that was hepatotoxic, the little sheet of paper that the pharmacist would give you would have that information on it and would say avoid drugs like acetaminophen. At least should say that. And again, generic acetaminophen is fine. Yes?
So acetaminophen does not have the blood thinning capability?
No, that's another property. Difference between it and, in fact, that aspirin is unique in that regard. Ibuprofen will interfere with coagulation as well, but it does more than just inhibit platelet function. So the only drug that's used for prevention of heart attack and stroke in folks who may be prone to it is aspirin, low-dose aspirin. So ibuprofen and naproxen also inhibit the prostaglandins. As I said, they're pretty good for the more serious kind or heavier sorts of pain. They have an anti-inflammatory effect that is not really there at the recommended dosage for over-the-counter use, which is 200 milligrams. 200 milligrams at each dose for, say, four times a day. That won't touch inflammation in most people. It might do it in some. In higher doses, though, it's very good for inflammation, but these are doses that should be prescribed by a physician. The physician can prescribe 600 to 800 milligrams at a dose, but that's the sort of dosage that usually requires clinical monitoring. Comes in tablets, capsules, and liquids, can irritate the stomach, can cause ulceration of the stomach, as can aspirin. Take it with food, and this would apply to aspirin as well, take it with food, milk, or antacids. That helps to relieve any intestinal damage that may occur, or gastrointestinal damage that may occur. It's also recommended that folks who drink three or more alcoholic drinks a day stay away from these drugs. And the generic products, again, are pretty good. Now.
You got a question back
yeah.
here?
Oh. Could you speak on the side effects, the renal side effects of
sure.
ibuprofen?
Ibuprofen and related drugs in this category, and there are several, but ibuprofen and naproxen are the only ones that are available over the counter. They have the ability to reduce blood flow through the kidneys, and where this is primarily a problem is in folks. This is the sort of thing that if you know that you have some kidney impairment, then it'd be wise to check with your physician before you start using ibuprofen. There was a time when this was considered to be one of the major problems with ibuprofen, but that problem has kind of diminished in importance in comparison to the effects on the gastrointestinal tract. But it's still there, and it raises again the point that no drug has a single action. Now, the way these drugs are marketed, in fact, the way most over-the-counter drugs are marketed, is for the manufacturer to put out a whole bunch of products under their brand name. You walk into a drugstore and you go down the pain reliever counter, and you walk for 50 feet, and it's all pain reliever things, and you say, "Oh my gosh, how am I going to make a choice here?" This it'll say it's for the back and body. It'll say it's extra strength. There'll be all sorts of things. Well, if you understand that there are only those four drugs that can be sold over the market, over the counter, as pain relievers, and if you understand that something like Bayer, that their big deal is aspirin, although they do sell acetaminophen, but their big deal is aspirin, then you can begin to sort through this family of products that they would like you to buy. This is all part of getting market share. Okay? And it's all, the implication is that, well, you ought to have Bayer, the wonder drug, on hand, but if you've got back and body pain, then maybe this is what you ought to get too. And if you've got a little trouble sleeping at night, well, then you get the PM version. Well, if we look at these, you're going to see, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Here's one that just blows me away. Here's the low dose aspirin, 81 milligrams, and then here's Bayer women's low dose, aspirin, 81 milligrams, and an antacid. Why do women need an antacid and men don't? I just don't get it. And at this dosage, the idea that there's going to be gastric irritation is pretty small.
Could it be calcium?
It might be calcium. It might be calcium that they're trying to put in here. I haven't looked at the label to see what the antacid is, but I'll bet you that's a good point. I'll bet you it's calcium carbonate. Then it depends on how much is there. And I don't know that it's going to be a lot. Then you've got an enteric coated variety. We've got the extra strength. And we find extra strength, and we find extra strength plus with an antacid. Now here, I'll guarantee you that the antacid is there to protect against the irritation that you might get from a 500 milligram tablet. And the usual dosage here is 2 tablets. So the regular dosage of aspirin is 650 milligrams. The extra strength dosage, which is the maximum allowable dosage, is 1,000 milligrams. And I'll guarantee you that the incidence of stomach irritation will go up when you're talking about 1,000 versus 600 milligrams. But then the question that I would ask is, why does one of these need an antacid and the other doesn't? This doesn't make any sense. There's another thing about extra strength. Now, 20 years ago, that was a big deal. This is how Excedrin made a lot of their money. Because they came up with, they got approval for extra strength Excedrin, and everybody had to catch up with them. Well, the usual regular dose is 650 milligrams, and the extra strength dose is 1,000 milligrams. Now, why do we have extra strength? Well, it goes back to this idea that different people have different sensitivities to drugs. And so for some people, and the way these usual doses are calculated or determined is that they're based on clinical trials that companies have run with their drugs to determine what are the effective doses and what is the effective dosage range. And sort of as a rule of thumb, what these folks arrive at with these doses is a dose that will be effective in about 2/3 of the people who take it. And so the idea here is we don't want to overload with the regular dosage. We don't want to overload everybody because people who are more sensitive to it don't need 1,000 milligrams. They only need 650 milligrams. They may even get by with somewhere between 325 and 650. And so the extra strength is really meant to fill that gap for people who are not responsive. But that's not the way these were sold. These were sold with the idea that if you want to really get your headache relieved, you need extra strength aspirin. This doesn't fly. But even if you want to play with this, if you want to experiment with whether or not 2 325 milligram tablets works or the extra strength works, you don't have to buy the extra strength product. You can do it with the regular aspirin because 3 regular strength aspirin tablets amounts to 975 milligrams, which is close enough by my calculation to the 1,000 milligrams that you get with the extra strength. Caffeine is here in this one, and I don't know why it's here and not in the others. There's clinical evidence that suggests that, indicates fairly well that caffeine will intensify the actions of aspirin, and that's one reason that caffeine is included in these cases. How much it intensifies it, I don't know. I think it may be a bit overblown, but the clinical evidence is there. So there are these questions you could raise about extra strength, but you don't even have to buy extra strength to get extra strength. All you need is a little bit of Bayer, the Wonder Drug, on the shelf. This one, Bayer PM, is a clever marketing ploy. It represents a clever marketing ploy as well. Here they've included an antihistamine, and this is the antihistamine that's in Benadryl. And if you have insomnia and you go to the drugstore to buy an over-the-counter sleep aid, it will have diphenhydramine, and it'll have about 50 milligrams of diphenhydramine. And diphenhydramine, among the antihistamines that are there, and we'll get to those shortly, is the most prone to cause drowsiness. And so that's what's there. And the Bayer people are saying, well, if you've got pain and you also have trouble sleeping, then try our product here that includes the sedative effects of diphenhydramine.
Trouble is you can't drive with that.
No, you can't. You shouldn't drive with if you use, but this is when you're going to bed.
Yeah.
And but my argument here is, and I think most clinicians will back this up, if pain is what's keeping you awake, then if you can take something that'll relieve the pain, you should be able to sleep. And so I wouldn't dash right out to buy something like this before I was convinced that that just the regular old aspirin didn't take care of this.
What's safer for your body, though, a gram of aspirin or 76 milligrams of diphenhydramine?
Diphenhydramine is a much safer drug. This is a pretty high dose. 76 milligrams may even blur your vision. But then, who cares if you're asleep, I guess. But that's a very high dose of diphenhydramine. Okay, and one other thing I want to say. If you keep aspirin on the shelf in your medicine cabinet, and when you open it, you smell vinegar, it's gone bad. It has released the acetylsalicylic acid, that's aspirin. And it has an acetyl group on it, and that acetyl group is what is the constituent of acetic acid, or vinegar. And so when that's released from the molecule, you're left with salicylic acid, which I said is not well absorbed orally, and it's just not going to work for you the way aspirin would. And what you smell is the vinegar from the acetic acid that has been released. If you smell it, throw it away. This is a case for not buying, whereas for acetaminophen, for ibuprofen, no problem at all with buying 500 tablet bottles. You know, the cheapest one you can get that'll give you the most tablets, it doesn't apply with aspirin. You don't want to keep aspirin sitting around unless it's enteric coated. If it's enteric coated, then it'll keep. But if it's not enteric coated, it won't keep. If moisture gets to it, it'll break down. And moisture will get to it if it's just in a screw cap bottle. Okay, any questions then on these internal pain relievers? Okay, let's spend a couple minutes talking about our external pain relievers, counter irritants. The way these things work, this class of drugs. It's been around for centuries, I suppose. But it works by the mechanism of, if it hurts here, if you make it hurt over here, let's take your mind off the hurt that's here. Okay? That's a basic principle. But these things don't make it hurt. What these things have are ingredients that cause, in the case of methyl salicylate, when you put it on the skin, you get a feeling of warmth. With camphor and menthol, you get a cooling sensation. Okay? Any of you who used to be smokers and smoked menthol cigarettes know what that's about. Or if you've taken menthol cough drops, you get this feeling of coolness. Well, these are not creating heat, and they're not creating cold. What they are doing is stimulating the nerve endings in your mouth, in the case of the lozenges, or in your skin, which send signals to your brain that says, I'm sensing heat, or I'm sensing cold. And if you've got a painful joint here, or you've got a bruise or some such, or a sore muscle here that's causing you pain, well, you're feeling the pain because the pain receptors in that region are sending signals to the brain that say it hurts. And the principle behind these counter irritants, associated also with the rubbing that goes with putting on the Bengay and some of these other things, is that it stimulates those nerve endings, and it sends nerve traffic up the same nerve pathways. And what it does is kind of crowd out the painful stimulus. And so the pain can be reduced and maybe even go away completely. But it's all related to setting up this different sensory process by stimulating these other nerve endings. The capsaicin works a little bit differently. There's a transmitter, the transmitter, one of the transmitters for these pain-sensing nerves is called substance P. I don't know why it's called substance P, but it's called substance P, just the letter P, not the P-E-E. Okay. And what capsaicin does is you put it on the skin and you rub it on the skin, or you just really apply it, and it is absorbed into this region of the skin, comes in contact with these nerve endings that are releasing substance P, and which is sending a signal that it hurts to the brain, and it depletes the nerve endings of the substance P. And as that depletion occurs, it occurs over the course of several days. So this is not going to, the capsaicin is not going to relieve your pain right now, whereas the methyl salicylate and the camphor will. But what it will do is relieve your pain gradually over a period of time, and then it'll stay relieved until the ability of those nerves to regenerate the substance P, get reaccumulated in the nerve endings, comes back. That's the whole idea, and this is a very clever idea, and it's a relatively new notion in terms of pain relief, but it's not without its problems. Then there's another one that's on the market, trolamine salicylate. You'll find this in some products. This is not recommended mainly because the clinical evidence doesn't show that it seems to work very well at all. And so I would say if you see a product that contains nothing but trolamine salicylate, don't buy it. You may see it in combination with one of these things up here. It won't be with the capsaicin necessarily. Then, sure, that's fine. But this is just one that you may see, and it's not considered to be one of the top line drugs here. Bengay is the one that will contain these sorts of things. Zostrix, and there may be others now that contain capsaicin. There are precautions and warnings that go with all of these. With methyl salicylate, you can get localized irritation, and there can be absorption into the systemic circulation. And salicylate intoxication can occur if this is really heavily used. And this is why the recommendation is that you don't use it with heating pads or exposure to heat, because that will promote the absorption into the systemic circulation. And so this is not a good idea. And because some of this will get into the blood by just simply being absorbed through the skin, then if you're taking anticoagulants because you've got a heart valve, an artificial heart valve, or some other reason, these would be anticoagulants that you're taking on a doctor's order. You don't want to be combining this with oral salicylates in that particular instance. Camphor should not be taken internally. It can be toxic. There have been instances of folks putting it into infants' nostrils to help relieve congestion. This is not a good idea. It will cause central nervous system toxicity. Menthol is relatively non-toxic, but there have been cases of allergy associated with it. Capsaicin is the one that really can cause the problems. It can cause burning and stinging. It's not, you don't want to put it on an open sore. If you do, or if you ever have, you know what I'm talking about. And you want to keep it away from your eyes, and it's recommended that you wear gloves to apply it, and then you remove the gloves. Because even if you have it on your fingers, and you wash your fingers, there may be a little bit on there, and if you happen to brush your eye, then this could really hurt. Or if you touch some other very sensitive parts of your body, that could lead to some problematic moments.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there a difference, are there different applications for the heat versus the cold sensations?
Not really. I think that's personal preference, at least what I know of it. Yeah. These are fairly, these are not mainline analgesic drugs. These are for relief of really minor muscle strains and so on that are going to get better in a few days anyway. And I think it's really just a matter of personal preference.
What does Vicks fall under?
Which?
Vicks.
Vapor rub?
Vicks. The Vicks vapor rub will have things like camphor okay. and menthol. I don't remember precisely what's in there, but it's a very aromatic thing. So, yeah. And it's, and I think it's, it would be camphor and menthol, or actually, I think it's probably methyl salicylate, because my recollection when my mother used to slather that stuff on my job is that it feels warm.
Yeah.
Oil of eucalyptus. Oil of eucalyptus.
Yes, that too. Okay, well, let's talk about cold remedies if there are no questions about the pain relievers, and we'll probably have to take this up again tomorrow. I hope not anybody leaving tomorrow. A few of you. Oh, okay. Oh, the cold remedies, that's another really interesting area from a pharmacologic standpoint, and it can be very complicated. There are probably more cold remedies out there, brand-wise and combination-wise, than pain relievers. But again, if you know what's in there, and you know what really works, and you really understand what these drugs can accomplish for you, the selection is really very simple. These are the approved classes of drugs that can be in over-the-counter cold remedies. Decongestants, antihistamines, analgesics, cough suppressants, and expectorants. That's kind of a disgusting sounding word, but we'll talk about these in detail here. Here's just a partial representation of the way these are represented across the market, with several different brands here, and you can see that there's some differences here, some gaps as we go, but for the most part, most of them will have a decongestant. A lot of them are going to have cough suppressants, antihistamines, and not very many will have expectorants, which is a good thing. Here is a list, almost complete, of all the drugs that could be or have been in over-the-counter cold remedies. I've put phenylpropanolamine and pseudoephedrine up here because they're historically relevant, but really the only one that you can buy directly off the counter now in most states contains only phenylephrine as the decongestant. In the days when you could get phenylpropanolamine and pseudoephedrine, phenylephrine was considered a third-tier drug. It's not absorbed very well. It's got a little bit more tendency to cause side effects than do these other ones, and this was considered to be just sort of third class. Now, it's the top tier drug because it's the only one that's available. And that tells you something about the quality of the decongestants that are out there. The antihistamines, now we have two types. We have those that cause sedation. Diphenhydramine and some of the others are in that category. And then we got these new ones, relatively new ones, that are called non-sedating. Claritin and Zyrtec, for example, are examples of these things that have gone from prescription-only status recently to over-the-counter. We already talked about the analgesics. Similarly with the cough suppressants, diphenhydramine has the ability to suppress coughs. And so it's included on this list, but not very many products actually contain that as a cough suppressant. Codeine is the old classic standby, but it's not available in many states because it's related to, these two both are related to the opium group of narcotics. But codeine has its habit-forming capabilities, and it causes constipation, whereas dextromethorphan does none of that. It's not a habit-forming drug. And it doesn't cause constipation. All it does, for the most part, is relieve cough, except, or suppress cough, except that for some reason that I don't understand, kids have discovered that dextromethorphan somehow gives them a high. And so this has become something of a drug of abuse in some areas. And then the only expectorant now that's available, there used to be several, is this thing called guaifenesin. I'll talk about these as we get into them one by one. So, phenylpropanolamine is no longer available. Pseudoephedrine is available in some states, but you have to ask the pharmacist for it. I noticed that over here, the cold remedies that are available in the store contain pseudoephedrine. I don't know what the law is in Washington, whether pseudoephedrine is still available.
It is. But
it is?
It is.
It is, okay. Well, it's one of the few states in which it is available on the open counter. There are some states that have even banned the sale of pseudoephedrine. Anybody know why we have this ban now on pseudoephedrine?
Meth.
This is what you take and you can make methamphetamine with it. So we've got phenylephrine. Now, in this category of decongestants, we've got two different types. We've got those that you take orally, and that would be the phenylephrine. Then we've got another group that I haven't listed here, but these are in the nose drops and nasal sprays, and we'll talk about them as well. What the decongestants do is constrict inflamed and swollen blood vessels in the nose and the pharynx, and that's how it relieves the congestion. You've got a drippy throat, you know, there's stuff dripping down into the back of your throat, irritating your throat, giving you a sore throat. The decongestant sometimes can relieve that because it stops that drippiness. The problem with decongestants, oral decongestants, is that they constrict blood vessels throughout the body, whether there's inflammation or not. This will increase blood pressure to some degree. It can increase heart rate. It can increase the central nervous system, make a person irritable, make them unable to sleep. And these are problematic effects. People who have high blood pressure or heart disease, thyroid disease, diabetes, difficult urination, should not be taking these oral decongestants because they can make a bad situation worse. The topical sprays are, this is a horse of a little bit different color. They work by the same mechanism. Oxymetazolone is one of the drugs in this group, and there are several, two or three drugs that are available in this category, but they all work the same way. And they constrict the inflamed and swollen membranes. They don't usually cause systemic effects because they don't get absorbed. If they're used correctly, they don't get absorbed to any significant degree into the systemic circulation. But nevertheless, some absorption can occur. And for that reason, there's the same do not use warning here as well as for these for the oral ones. The big problem with these drugs is a phenomenon known as rebound congestion. And that's why it's recommended that these products be used for no more than 3 days in a row. What rebound congestion is all about is that when the mucous membranes, now the vessels in the membranes have been constricted in the presence of the drug, they develop what amounts to a super sensitivity now to the inflammation process that was at work, and when the effect of the drug wears off, the congestion comes back, and it may be worse than it was in the first place. And when it comes back, it's natural to think, well, the effect of the drug is gone, squirt some more in there, but it's a vicious cycle that the congestion and the rebound fashion builds. And the clinical literature has many examples of situations where patients went for weeks using a spray or an inhaler long after their cold symptoms went away, should have gone away, and they had nasal congestion. And the nasal congestion was something they were producing by continuing to use the spray or the inhaler. And so it's imperative that you follow the directions if you're going to use these. These are very, very good. You know, if you're troubled by changes in altitude when you fly, and you get pressure built up in your ears. Afrin nasal spray has gained a reputation for being helpful in relieving that kind of pressure, but that's just for an occasional kind of usage. It's not the kind of thing that you want to use on a prolonged basis.
Well, I have a comment.
Yeah.
My doctor this past year for a really severe sinus infection recommended a neti pot. And I was floored how quick, immediate, and effective it was compared to all the stuff I've been taking. And now when I have
the oral, so much more effective than the
oral medication. I mean, trust me, I tried everything that I could find over the counter.
And you're putting the drug where it's needed. You know, when you take it orally, it's got to travel all through the body and get to these membranes. And whereas if you're putting it in as a spray or...
Well, it's always the same thing. Yeah, you just need to have all the...
Salt water.
Oh, you're talking about a neti
pot.
Oh, right. Yeah, that is a big deal. That was... You're jumping the gun on me. I didn't hear when you said neti pot. Yeah, the
just saying, give it a try.
The neti pot replaces the need for a decongestant cold medicine in many cases. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, with the antihistamines, I'll just take a couple of minutes here. We won't go into this in great detail, but the don't look at the difference here as an absolute difference. The Claritin and the Zyrtec are referred to as non-sedating. They're not non-sedating. It's a function of dosage. That's illustrated here. Here is the, if this is all the people who were, like if we took all of you and we gave you diphenhydramine and we gave you enough to relieve allergic symptoms, let's say you all had hay fever, then we would give increasing doses here until we had all of you treated with the Benadryl and relieved your allergic symptoms. And we would have, most of you would also be drowsy. Not necessarily everybody, but the drowsiness curve is very close to the relief of allergic symptoms curve. And so that's why this is such a sedating drug. With Claritin, the curve is separate. With chlortrimeton, which is not as sedating, it's moved a little away from the relief of allergic symptoms curve, and with loratadine or Claritin, it's moved even further. So when we gave everybody a sufficient dose of loratadine to relieve the allergic symptoms, we would find that maybe a few of you would feel drowsy, but not very many of you. And so this is the idea that you can recruit these other effects by giving more. It's not that there's something special about loratadine that it doesn't cause drowsiness. It's just that in the doses that relieve allergic symptoms, you're not going to get enough of it, in most cases, to cause the drowsiness. Okay, make sense? Okay.
I have a question about allergies. My husband is very allergic to, he's been allergic for 60 years, and it seems like they have not done much at all to help him. He's gone through shots and, the whole thing, but it's, seems like a very slow moving industry to help people with allergies.
Yeah, well, that's a whole separate practice of medicine, and it's not it's a messy one because there are so many differences with respect to what causes allergies in folks, and we used to think of it, well, if you're allergic to something, it means that whatever it is that you're allergic to is causing your body to release histamine, and that causes the allergic symptoms, and if we give an antihistamine, that takes it away. Well, that works for some people, but it doesn't work for everybody, and we know that there are many mediators of allergic responses now, and the fact of the matter is we don't have medications that interfere with all of those mediators. That's really what it amounts to. Just a quick word, and then we'll stop. I won't say anything more about analgesics, but I need to say something about cough suppressants. Cough suppressants are, there's not a rational basis, in my view, for putting a cough suppressant in a cough or a cold medicine that might contain all of these different categories of drugs. That's because some coughs should be suppressed, but some coughs should not be suppressed. A cough that should not be suppressed is what we call a productive cough, a cough that brings phlegm and other debris up when you've had a cold. And the cough is performing as it should be performing to clear your airway of this junk. And you don't want to be suppressing that cough. If the cough is non-productive, it's a dry hacking cough, it's a cough that's not producing phlegm and the like, maybe like a smoker's cough or this sort of thing, sure. That can be suppressed, especially if it's keeping you awake or if it's driving your coworkers crazy. Then that's fine. But the argument here is in favor of not buying a cough remedy or cold remedy that contains a cough suppressant, because not every cough is going to need to be suppressed. The best cough suppressant that's available is dextromethorphan. I wouldn't bother with codeine. I wouldn't bother with diphenhydramine. The expectorants, I'll just make a quick thing about this. This is the last slide, and then we'll stop for now. But this whole idea, we can make this real simple. An expectorant is something that is meant to increase mucus flow in your airway when your cold has kind of dried things up, and you've got a dry throat, you've got dry nasal membranes. The expectorant is designed to promote mucus production and to wet the airway and to relieve the irritation that is associated with just breathing in a dry airway. What's interesting and I think problematic is the way that it works. What guaifenesin does is it doesn't act anywhere near your airway. It acts in your stomach. It stimulates the same nerve endings that get stimulated when you develop nausea. What happens when you get nauseated? What do you feel? What, before you heave?
Water in the mouth.
Your saliva flows. Your mucous membranes are producing. That's how guaifenesin works. And in some people, the dose that's recommended for guaifenesin, 200 milligrams, is enough to make them nauseated and induce vomiting. The better way to wet your airway is to drink water, is to drink plenty of fluids. That's why they say drink lots of water when you have a cold. That's the best way to produce mucus. Mucus is nothing but water. So we'll drop that. Oh, I'm going to go. Here we go. Then we'll drop that from our list. We're going to drop the cough suppressant because we don't want to buy a cold remedy that's got this in it. If you already have a pain reliever that's your favorite pain reliever at home, there's no point in buying a product that has more pain reliever. We'll drop that one from the list. The antihistamine that's in some of these products is might be helpful to you if some of your symptoms are being caused by allergy. And that's sometimes the case with a cold, but not always. And so the clinical literature is divided here. In situations where histamine is involved, the antihistamine can be effective in relieving some of the symptoms. But if histamine is not part of what's involved in making you feel rotten when you have a cold, it's not going to work. So I just draw a line through it as opposed to... and so here we are, we've got a decongestant. That's all you need. And what I say, I lied, this is my last slide. The way to use an oral OTC cold remedy is buy one that only contains a decongestant, if you want to get an oral decongestant. It's not going to be easy to do that, but you can find one that contains an antihistamine and a decongestant and nothing else. You can experiment if you've got availability to pseudoephedrine to see which of these you like and if they really do work for you. I suggest that you buy a liquid formulation because you've got better control of the dosage. You can titrate the dose. If the usual dose of the phenylephrine or the pseudoephedrine makes you jittery, keeps you awake, well then you could, with a liquid formulation, you can take a little bit less and thereby perhaps titrate the effects. Again, buy generic. Keep a bottle of a liquid cough suppressant on hand and a supply of your pain reliever if you need it. Drink lots of fluid. Suck on candy. That's what I use for my sore throat. Stay home. Get plenty of rest. And remember that most colds get better in about a week anyway.
A neti pot
should be on the list, although I can't. I hate them. But my wife uses them religiously. And
I think there's another form of that, too. Just a squeeze bottle. That's simple.
Yeah, I think I'm being waterboarded.
That's absolutely. That's what I think of it.
I start giving up my secret.
Yeah. Well, can somebody explain what that is? Because I don't know.
It's a nasal irrigation thing.
It's like a little pot that allows you to rinse your nasal passages with saline, which is just salt water.
I do that just on my own without that.
I mean, it works wonders. Well, that's all we'll cover today. If you're here tomorrow, come on back and we'll finish this off and we'll talk about sunscreens. There are some new rules coming out on sunscreens and a few other products, and then whatever you want to talk about, we'll talk about as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, there's another remedy I meant to tell you. If all else fails, there's the two-hat treatment, which I would just love. You get a hat, you get ready for bed, you go to your liquor cabinet, and you get your favorite beverage, be it bourbon or...